By remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S. House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to meet President Donald Trump's demand of $2,000 relief checks for most Americans. The stimulus relief checks, which currently stand at $600, are part of the more than $2 trillion government funding package President Trump signed into law on Sunday. The measure now goes to the Senate. The president last week threatened to block the massive pandemic aid and spending package if Congress did not boost stimulus payments and cut other spending. The House of Representatives also voted to override President Trump's veto of a $740 billion defense policy bill. If the Senate this week follows the House action, it would be the first veto override of Trump's presidency. President-elect Joe Biden said on Monday that many of America's security agencies had been hollowed out under President Trump, and the lack of information being provided to his transition team by the outgoing administration was an irresponsibility. Biden said his team has encountered roadblocks from the political leadership at the Department of Defense and the Office of Management and Budget. Trump, a Republican, has refused to concede defeat in the November 3rd election, and his administration delayed authorized cooperation with Biden until November 23rd. Biden takes office on January the 20th. U.S. authorities said passengers arriving from Britain must test negative for COVID-19 72 hours before departure. That new order became effective on Monday. A court in Shanghai, China, sentenced a former lawyer and citizen journalist, Zhang Zan, to 4 years in prison for her reporting on the coronavirus outbreak. Zhang was one of the several citizen journalists who covered the initial outbreak in China's central city of Wuhan. Their coverage painted a far more serious picture of conditions in the government's official narrative of the spreading infection. A Chinese human rights lawyer who asked to remain anonymous told VOA that the four-year sentence is extremely harsh. Picking quarrels and provoking trouble usually leads to a fixed-term imprisonment of no more than 5 years. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said he is reimposing a ban on alcohol sales and ordered the closure of all bars as necessary steps to control a resurgence of the coronavirus, including a new variant of the virus. During a televised address Monday night, Ramaphosa also announced residents will remain under a nighttime curfew, meaning they must remain in their homes between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., but medical and security workers are excluded from the curfew. Following an emergency meeting with his cabinet, Ramaphosa also said anyone caught not wearing a mask in a public place faces a fine and possible jail time. A huge U.S. study, that is, of another possible COVID-19 vaccine is getting underway, as states continue to roll out supplies of the first shots cleared for emergency use. Novavax is recruiting 30,000 volunteers to test its shots. Doses of one vaccines made by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna are rationed, and more options are critical to providing enough shots for the country and the world. Johnson & Johnson hopes to know next month if its one-dose option works, and Britain is considering greenlighting an AstraZeneca shot. Russia's Federal Penitentiary Service gave Alexei Navalny 1 day to report to its office or face imprisonment. The service saying Monday he will be in prison if he returns after the deadline. The prison service demanded that Navalny report to its office in line by the terms of a suspended 3.5-year sentence he received for 2014 conviction. Navalny, a leading Kremlin critic, is recovering in Germany after he was poisoned by a nerve agent in August. Russian authorities have denied the Kremlin was involved in his poisoning. Navalny fell into a coma while aboard a domestic flight from Siberia to Moscow. And France is mourning the deaths of 3 soldiers killed in a roadside bombing in Mali. The French government said the soldiers' armored vehicle struck an explosive device during their mission fighting an Islamist extremist insurgency in Africa's Sahel region. Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Peacekeeping Mission in Mali releases a report on human rights violations during the M5 protest movement.
This was a sad moment in the history of Mali that an elected president would use disproportionate force against protesters with no weapons at all.
Ugandan journalists demand an apology after the military accuses them of activism. We'll have a conversation with Uganda's only female presidential candidate, 2020 reflections from South Africa, and Sudan sends its military to South Darfur to quell tribal clashes.
It is a mere consequence of the departure of UNAMID over there, and it seems that the government is not ready yet to take over maintaining the security over there in Darfur.
And Ghana's capital businesswomen support their northern counterparts. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Integrated Multidimensional Stabilization Mission in Mali, also known as MINUSMA, Monday released a report about its investigation into alleged human rights violations and abuses committed during the M5 protest in July this year. The report said 14 demonstrators, including 2 children, were killed during intervention by security forces. Yas Samake is a Malian politician in Bamako.
After reading the report from MINUSMA, it confirms the number of people killed during this 3 days event. It was very unfortunate that to keep himself into power and the cronies of the outing regime use our defense forces to repress legally approved protests in Mali. This was a sad moment in the history of Mali that an elected president would use disproportionate force against protesters with no weapons at all. The report indicates that there have been 14 people killed in total during those 3 days events. And we hope that the judiciary in Mali that has opened actually these hearings will request this document and use it as a tool to prosecute those who engage in violating the constitution and human rights, in repressing violently and in a disproportionate manner civilians in this country.
On the one hand, the MINUSMA report says that people were injured and people were killed and others arrested. Yet it says that under Malian law, these acts violate the National Penal Code and are punishable by the competent court. Are they saying that they don't have jurisdiction to make a major decision on this?
It is already a credible report that they put forth, and that can be used by the judicial system in Mali to prosecute under the law those who engage in these violations. The mandate of the United Nations does not allow them to prosecute Malians here for crime committed in Mali, so they have to use the judicial system. The report is available, and they have specifics, and they said they have footage and pictures, and that there have been testimonies of people who were direct and indirect witnesses of these violations and killings of young children. This needs to be dealt with promptly. I think that the government of Mali recognized this, the transitional government recognized this, and they have opened a judicial hearing and asking Malian people detailing information, and I believe they will request it. MINUSMA said they possess this information and will be made available to the judiciary system in Mali upon request.
Do you think all those protesters led by the M5, do you think they feel vindicated?
Well, of course, it was a repression. It was, the regime that was fighting to survive. So it was a survival mode from the outing regime. The people of Mali have requested the resignation of the president. And by attempting to capture or kill the M5 leadership, they were faced by people willing to face with empty hands, bullets and gunshots. So this led to the killings of many when they were attempting to capture the one of the leaders of the M5. Yes, these killings were vindicated by the president and the prime minister's office, and that's why it is going to be prosecuted. And we believe that no such behavior or violations should be encouraged in Mali or any country in the world.
Thank you so much again for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Anytime. Thank you, James.
Yasemake is a Malian politician. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bamako. Journalists in Kampala walked out of a news conference on Monday after a top military officer accused them of being political activists. Tensions were running high ahead of the event after three journalists were allegedly attacked and injured by security forces while covering an opposition political rally on Sunday. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
On Sunday night, journalists received a text message inviting them to a Monday morning press conference with the chief of Uganda's Defense Forces, General David Muhoozi. However, upon arrival, the 30 journalists who had come in were addressed instead by the political commissar for the Uganda People's Defense Forces, Brigadier General Henry Matsiko. After speaking about the upcoming 40th anniversary of the UPDF, Matsiko was asked why journalists are being targeted. Three journalists, including Ali Mivule of NTV Uganda and Ashraf Kasiri of Ghetto TV, were hit with tear gas canisters and rubber bullets by security forces on Sunday in the Masaka district. Kasiri was badly hurt and had to be put in a medically induced coma. The journalists were covering a campaign appearance by Bobi Wine, presidential candidate of the opposition National Unity Platform Party. Matsiko lectured the journalists, accusing them of being unprofessional and taking sides in the presidential campaign.
Even listening to some of you, the way you are presenting yourselves, I get an impression that you are moving into a different terrain of activism. And activism has its own dynamics. So once you are a journalist, prove to us that you are exercising professionalism. I have already regretted, and I'm saying, let us all, please.
Why don't you arrest me? Why do you shoot me?
We need to be fair and treated.
This time, yes, I know, I understand.
The comments caused an uproar and journalists walked out of the news conference. Michael Kakumiro, a photojournalist with the Daily Monitor newspaper, who says he has previously been beaten by security forces, demanded that Matsiko apologize.
He came and started lecturing us as if we were politicians. We are not politicians. What we owe from security is an apology, and that has to come from the CDF himself.
The journalists are also demanding that top security officers issue a statement warning junior officers to allow journalists work in safety. They also want Enoch Abaine, the officer who shot at Mivule and commanded the operation Sunday in Masaka, to be arrested, tried and penalized. Abubakar Lubowa, another Daily Monitor photojournalist, says their actions are in solidarity with their hospitalized colleagues.
What hurts us? Some of us have been covering state functions. But the moment you cover the opposition, then you become a bad journalist. The moment you cover the ruling government, then you are a very good journalist. So what should we do in this country? We love our country, but we can't work under such conditions.
After walking out of the media center, journalists were surrounded by security forces that included 15 police motorcycles, a police pickup truck, local defense unit officers armed with AK-47 rifles, and a police holding van. When asked why army officials had asked for reinforcement, UPDF spokesperson Brigadier General Flavia Biekwaso said the deployment was a mistake.
So these guys thought that actually you are under a problem. That's why they came as a rescue team. And you saw me coming out to tell them that no, there was no problem.
Yes.
We are going to use our cameras.
Journalists insist they will only resume covering security functions once they get an apology from the proper officials. Uganda votes for a new president on January 14. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Uganda's independent presidential candidate, Nancy Kalembe, the only female candidate among the 11 presidential aspirants, says she is optimistic to win the next elections. Nancy Kalembe says, as a woman and a mother, she is the best suitable candidate, and tells reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji in Kampala that she inspires young females to believe in themselves.
For me, this journey started when I was 17 years old. No, 14 years old. I was 14 years old. I was in senior one in Namagunga. I started preparing myself, going to studying leadership's different books of leadership, finding mentors, and basically preparing myself for this. As I kept on growing up, I asked different questions. So how much our country was deteriorating.
And during that time, since when you're 14, did you ever take up some positions of leadership demonstrated that you could become a better leader?
Definitely. I've been a leader since I stepped into school. I've been a leader from the most basic class monitress in school all the way to organizational leadership. The most latest role was I set up an oil company in Uganda called Asharame Uganda, and it's been performing well.
That was Nancy Kalembe, Uganda's independent presidential candidate, speaking with reporter Mugumi Davis Rakariji in Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 29th. Sudan says it has sent a contingent of its military to South Darfur to quell tribal clashes that resulted in the death of 15 people. Reports say a verbal altercation between members of the Masalit and Falata tribes over a water source generated into gun battles. Former Sudanese diplomat Khalil Musa says the clashes are a direct result of the pending departure this week of the UN and African Union peacekeeping mission in Darfur and the lack of preparedness by the Sudanese government to assume security responsibilities.
There is a tribal conflict that's broke out in Darfur, especially between two major tribes, who are Masalit and Falata, who they used to fight over natural resources and mainly pasture for their animal and water resources. This happening during the evacuation of UNMID, that is the UN African Union hybrid force that is responsible for maintaining security in Darfur, and the international community asked the government of Sudan to take over the regional security in Darfur. So the government, federal government, sending this troop in order to maintain security and order over there and to contain these tribal clashes, not to spill over, and to make any security chaos over there. But it is a mere consequence of the departure of UNMID over there, and it seems that the government is not ready yet to take over maintaining the security and containing any kind of tribal and internal clashes over there in Darfur.
In that light, Ambassador, do you think it's wise that the UN peacekeeping mission there to leave? As you know, the departure date is, I think, it's the 31st of December.
I think definitely it's not premature, definitely, for the UN and African hybrid forces to leave. But it seems that the government hasn't yet made the right preparation to take over responsibility of security in Darfur over there. And it seems that there is a lack of preparation for the federal government to take over the security. And I think the departure of UNMID and the government of Sudan taking over the security should go parallel, step by step. But it seems that there is a gap, an orchestrated gap and steps between the departure of UNMID and the government taking over security in Darfur.
I thought there was an attempt towards reconciliation. Was it between the government and the tribes or between the two tribes?
I mean, these clashes between Masalit over there in Darfur happened last October. Unfortunately, it renewed again. And there is reconciliation process definitely going on. But in this situation in Darfur right now, according to the political and security vacuum that has been witnessed in Darfur, I don't think this kind of reconciliation will take place very soon. Right now, the government interest is to stop the conflict and to contain the conflict, not to spill over to the other part of Darfur that might create further security chaos over there. But the reconciliation is not avoidable, and the armed group of Darfur, like the Sudan Revolutionary Front, like the Equality and Justice Movement led by Jibril Ibrahim, the other one led by Minni Minawi, they should get involved as soon as possible, because they had struck the deal in Sudan and in Darfur. But unfortunately, they are still in Khartoum. They are still not yet being appointed to take care of responsibility in Darfur in the federal government. I think there is some kind of political gap, security gap in the federal government, a regional government in Darfur, and Juba peace agreement haven't been yet fully implemented in Darfur.
Khalid Musa is a former Sudanese diplomat. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Many South Africans have described 2020 as a lost year. Most of them spent two quarters of the year under lockdown with no income. Many companies, especially in the food industry, either closed completely or only partially reopened. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
A year of sickness, burials, and poverty. This is how many South Africans have described the year 2020. Others say it's the worst year in the country's history, including those years spent under apartheid. On the health front, over 1 million people were infected by the coronavirus in 2020. COVID-19-related deaths are nearing 30,000. On the economic front, tens of thousands were left jobless. Many of those who were able to remain in their jobs had their wages reduced to enable their companies to stay afloat. Johannesburg resident Stella Mazu says there are no words to describe the devastation experienced in 2020.
2020 has been a very painful year. We started this year happy, having so many plans that never came to avail. We've lost so many friends, so many families. We've lost our jobs, our source of incomes. As we face 2021, we're facing it with so much uncertainty.
And Imtiaz Suleiman, the founder of the Gift of the Givers, a South African-based international humanitarian organization, says the humanitarian crisis experienced in 2020 was the first of its kind.
COVID-19, its challenges, the hopes, you know, the difficulty, the depression, the sadness, the job losses, the anxiety of medical professionals, families affected, and people, you know, who are in good standing, losing their jobs, losing everything overnight after the lockdown.
Many say long periods of lockdown made all aspects of life harder. Lita Vuge, a student at the University of Johannesburg, says 2020 was the most difficult year for students.
Definitely, I'll describe 2020 as a challenging year, terrifying year. It meant hard to navigate through academic year. Teachers had challenges. How do we continue and save the academic year amidst the pandemic? It's been scary. It's been traumatizing. It's been everything bad you can think of.
Athletes and artists were not spared. André Leroux is the founder of the IKS Africa, a live concert promotion company.
It was devastating. By the end of March, all the South African tours were cancelled. The last gigs for many artists was December last year. And now, March, April, May, June, July, August, people haven't been performing. We were devastated. We got calls. At one stage, I was arranging food parcels for artists.
For many South Africans, it's a year they will want to quickly forget. Some wish it could be deleted from the calendar, while others want it declared a year that was never lived. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Northern Ghana is underdeveloped, and women have borne the brunt of it with the high levels of poverty and few economic opportunities. Business women in the capital are trying to help by working with Northerners to make unique products to sell locally and to international markets. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
In Accra, some women-owned businesses are working with non-profits and women about 700 kilometres north, sourcing raw materials for their goods, such as shea butter. The butter, extracted from the nut of the African shea tree, is a staple in Violet Amorbing's line of natural beauty products. She says one of the goals of her business, Skin Gourmet, is to help women keep the next generation out of poverty through economic empowerment.
So we ensure that they're able to use the profits or the money they get from our purchases to improve their livelihood by doing things like building clinics, taking their children to school, and ensuring that they have a job.
Mobarika Awudu supports women in the north by buying handmade fabrics from local women to make bags for markets in Accra. Her father came from a northern village, so she is aware of the hardships in the region. She says women's economic independence has become especially important this year as incomes were stretched from COVID-19.
Some of them are doing well. They have started with weaving alone. Now they have apprentices that they are training as well. Especially now that the schools are locked down, most of the girls are now learning how to make a livelihood from weaving.
Threaded Tribes puts a modern twist on traditional fashion to encourage young people to appreciate African fabrics. Awurama Mankata sources her fabrics from across Africa, including from women weavers in Ghana's north.
The fact that they are women makes me happy. There are barely any men weavers, to be honest, because they be in the farms, and even the women be in the farms too, but the weaving is a women business, and being a woman and a black woman at that, it's amazing. It's so amazing to be able to do this with women, to be honest. It's great.
While the north produces quality materials enjoyed across the world, there are few economic opportunities there, forcing young people to move south, many to already crowded cities. Much more needs to be done to help young women build their futures in the north, including investments and improved education, business and livelihood conditions, entrepreneurship expert Sheena Lovia Boateng says.
In terms of development, when you look at all the different regions in Ghana, some of the most deprived can be found in the north. So it's only fair that given that they are giving us so much value, at least we give back a bit to ensure that the community also thrives.
More investments and commitment to sustainable business practices would come with improved economic development in the north, leading to better outcomes for all, she said. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
And that's it for this Tuesday, December 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, the reporters Peter Clotty and Ray Keish Triak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.